farmers and consumers are being squeezed on both sides, and this is because of the increasing complexity of the food system and the supply chain that's causing that. So we really do have to pay a lot of attention to it.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Usually on Vox Dev Talks, we talk about specific pieces of economic research, but this week we're casting the net wider. We're talking about a new textbook called Food Economics. As you're going to hear, it brings together topics covering the food system, agribusiness, nutrition, and health. But who is it for? And what can the readers learn from it? Will Masters of Tufts and Amelia Finneray of Allegheny College are the authors, and they join me now. Will, hello.
Hi, Tim.
And Amelia, welcome.
Hi, Tim.
First of all, it's called Food Economics, two words. Is the idea of this book for people to learn about food through economics or to learn about economics through food?
It's definitely both. So we definitely want to have economists who maybe have not explored the food system as part of their work to be able to familiarize themselves with all kinds of aspects of the food system and how it works, because their perspective as economists is really important to the food system. And the food system is unique as a sector in so many ways that they may not have had the opportunity to learn that material before. But we also wrote the book so that students could learn about economics through food. Food is a good that everyone intersects with every day, multiple times per day. Mm-hmm. People make choices about their food every day, and it makes it just very conducive for using economics to analyze, because economics is all about analyzing and understanding observable choices. Because people are so familiar with food choices, it just makes it a really great way to learn about economics overall.
Now, one aspect of economics that's always controversial is the economics of textbook prices. You are open access. How did that happen? Why is it important to be open access?
Well, very fortunate. So this came through a project that I helped to lead called the Agriculture Nutrition Health Academy. It's actually headquartered in London at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And I head up a number of parts of the academy. And it's funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And as you might know, they have had a commitment to funding publishers' open access publication fees. And so they were willing to pay the $20,000 to make this free to everyone. And that window is closing. They've changed their blank check to publishers, but we fit right in the window. And so it is free to anyone.
What sort of students are going to benefit from this? What type of teachers are going to be using it?
We think that students in all different types of fields and disciplines could benefit from using the book. A lot of students are interested in food, and they come at it from many different directions. They might come from the environmental side and soil science and agronomy, and that's kind of the area of the food system that they're interested in. Mm-hmm. They can definitely benefit from learning about food economics and the economics of crop production, for example. Also, students who come from the health side, so public health and nutrition students, epidemiology students, I think could benefit as well, because they can see some of the determinants of health and how those things occur for people in the economy. So students from all different kinds of fields could benefit from it. There's also increasing numbers of programs at the undergraduate and graduate level in food systems, and food economics is an important aspect of their training as well. In terms of instructors, we would think that economists from all over the world might be interested in using the book for their classes. One great thing about it is that you can use single chapters of the book. You wouldn't have to use the whole thing necessarily. And that's part of the open access, the benefit to being open access, that instructors can pick and choose what works best for their classes. For example, a course that was looking at food production might look at the production theory chapter as well as international trade maybe, but it wouldn't necessarily cover consumption and health. So it's really flexible in that way for instructors to pick and choose what they need.
And I guess being open access as well, then that makes it more accessible for instructors and students in low-income settings.
Definitely, yes.
Now, this is also very different to what I'm usually reading when I'm prepping for a Vox Dev Talks, in that you do not use heavy mathematics, econometrics in the book. Why not?
Yeah, it's a great feature, I think. I think VoxDev listeners chose economics.
Yeah.
Often are specialized in economics and might not quite be aware how scary economics can be to people who maybe don't like the abstraction, maybe don't like some of the specialized jargon where economists have taken plain English words and used them in a very specialized way. Just for example, marginal means something in economics that it does not mean in everyday life. In everyday life, it means something that's been excluded that is not important. In economics, it's the central thing, and so on and so forth. And the math is really frightening to many students, especially often mission-driven students who want to work with people in contrast to more academically minded students. So we have not only focused entirely on the graphical principles, but we've streamlined those graphical principles so that the diagrams all use the same notation throughout, the same visual structure. The thing of interest is always quantity of X on the X-axis for an individual in indifference curves and production possibility frontiers, and for society in supply-demand diagrams. And then we have also change the language a little bit, where economists are used to saying, oh, optimization is the model of choice.
Mm-hmm.
But we, in teaching people who chose not to take economics and chose not to stay with it after they did Econ 101, you know, we describe that as people doing the best they can, as people choosing from their available options that which will meet their aspirations, and talk about choices, as Amelia said at the start, which everyone is familiar with, talk about it in familiar terms. And I think this has been really helpful to meet students where they are and help students learn these abstract concepts in concrete material examples from the food system and also natural language. And I hope this is helpful to economists too, to remember that we use the word equilibrium, thinking of it as not necessarily good, but everyone else, when they hear the word equilibrium, they think that means it's good because they think that means it's balanced,
yeah,
because that's how they use the term. And so we just call it a prediction. If a model has a prediction, then we can use that to assess whether a policy or intervention is likely to have a certain outcome for society. And I think economists can, I hope, recognize that all the concepts are faithfully described in the textbook. This is a, in some sense, generic vanilla principles of economics textbook, but there's language here, as well as the analytical diagrams laid out with concrete examples in natural language, English, that I hope people will appreciate.
Most of what I learned about food economics, I learned from the development economics syllabus. You both teach food economics as a standalone subject. Do you think it's important to teach it as a separate subject?
Yeah, we do. If you think about development economics as a subfield of economics, the goal of it is to understand and to try to improve using policy, evidence-based policy, the lives of people living in poverty to improve well-being. And food is one of the biggest determinants of well-being there is. Mm-hmm. Half of all child deaths in the world are due to malnutrition of some form. There's an increasing global burden of non-communicable disease as well, which is determined in large part by the foods that people eat. So not only is food economics important for people who are living at the lowest end of the income distribution in the world, people living in extreme poverty, but it's also important at higher ends where, you know, things become even more complicated. So yes, because food is such an important determinant of well-being overall, it has to be, I think, a standalone thing, and that it can complement the study of development economics in a really important way.
So I see from the book that you really do go back to basics on how the modern food system works. Why is it that students, I suppose even teachers as well, might lack knowledge about this?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I think of food as something that's hidden in plain sight. As Amelia said, everyone interacts with food, make choices about food every day. But the food system is dispersed in space. Mm-hmm. So its production is in the regions of origin of each type of food. And then it goes through this very complicated maze or network, a mesh of interacting value chains to get to consumers wherever they are. And I think there's basically three reasons why we don't understand it, even though we interact with it. One is that research on it has become really specialized. And research about food for production happens where production occurs. So my first PhD student, you know, really wonderful brilliant guy called Tim Dalton, went to Columbia University, the urban center of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to work on production for farmers in Africa and has a brilliant career in Manhattan. But it's Manhattan, Kansas, at Kansas State University, you know, big center for research on dry land agriculture. Of course, Kansas is mainly interested in wheat, but it turns out those same crop models apply for millet, sorghum, other dry land grains mm-hmm. that people rely on in Africa. And so you have to be willing to work in this specialized environment, in my case, in West Lafayette, Indiana, at Purdue University. And then the jobs for students for undergraduate education, you know, there's been in the United States zero growth in employment in agricultural production for decades. There used to be a decline. That decline has ended. It's roughly constant now. And so all the job opportunities for undergraduates are in other fields. And then a third reason is that we succeeded in bringing down the cost of food through this specialized research system, that it fell off the radar. When I was an undergraduate at Yale University, you know, I'm pretty old. This was early 80s. There was Economics of Agriculture 1 and Economics of Agriculture 2, and then Economics of Agriculture in Africa. Each of those was taught because we were fresh out of, and even indeed still in, massive famines. That is no longer the case today.
Yeah.
Famines still exist. They're very important, but they're much smaller numbers of people, and they're caused primarily by the conflicts and the politics around the famine location. For all those reasons, we forgot about agricultural production or isolated it in the research in specialized institutions in remote locations. And then we separate health. So research on health is done on health science campuses, mm-hmm. funded by specialized agencies, by faculty who are primarily researchers, not teachers. And that means that connecting the dots has been really difficult.
Believe me, Will, early 80s, that's not old. You described your textbook very modestly as vanilla economics, but you give a lot of attention to market power and collective action, probably more so than a standard textbook would. Why is that?
That's a really important aspect of the food system. I do think, though, that all intro economics textbooks are going to give you theory about monopolies, about even monopsonies, which are situations in which there's a single buyer, about other degrees of market concentration where there's only a few sellers or only a few buyers. You're going to usually have that. It does feature really prominently in our book for one reason, which is because of the structure of the food system. And the food system has been transforming into a much more complex structure, and food has been traveling through longer and longer supply chains. From when it comes out of the ground until when it gets on your plate, those supply chains have been getting longer and more complex. And so one thing that goes along with that is differences in market structure. So you need a lot of different more types of companies, for example, inputs to farming and agricultural production. And there's not that many of those input producers to provide inputs such as seeds and fertilizer to farmers. But there's a lot of farmers in the world. So when they're buying inputs, they get squeezed. And then when the farmers are selling their output to manufacturers and processors, there's not that many of those. So those farmers get squeezed again when they're selling their goods. And then consumers face monopoly power as well when they're buying food, whether it's in grocery stores or in certain types of foods being packaged. Farmers and consumers are being squeezed on both sides, and this is because of the increasing complexity of the food system and the supply chain that's causing that. So we really do have to pay a lot of attention to it. So we cover monopolies, monopsonies, and other types of market power and strategic interaction in the book, such as through game theory, which is how you study a few sellers or just a few buyers. Mm-hmm. And then we also cover the barriers to collective action and why that matters for the food system.
The enormous size of some of these multinational businesses contrasts very much with the size of most farms in sub-Saharan Africa or Asia. What can we usefully learn about the consequences of these small farm size?
One of the aspects of ignorance about how agriculture and food systems actually work is that most people don't appreciate that farms everywhere in the world remain, and in fact are increasingly, family operations. They're family farms around the world, mm-hmm. whether that's a tiny impoverished farm in growing cotton in Mali, for example, or a millionaire affluent cotton farmer in Mississippi, you know, in the United States, those are both family operations, meaning that it's mom, pop, and the kids doing the work, sometimes cousins, sometimes a brother. Mom, pop, and the kids could be a very large family in the Sahel region. You could have a household survey come with a clipboard and ask who's a member of this family. In the Sahel, they might tell you 30 or even 40 people are in the same family with multiple moms and a grandfather who's the sort of nominal head of the household. And then in many settings, it's just a part-time employment for the farm family. But there's no outside investors to speak of. They borrow, but they don't have equity owners. And there are no full-time year-round employees to speak of. There are, of course, exceptions. Outside investors can build successful crop operations for tea, for sugar, and those remain plantation crops. Mm-hmm. But for coffee, cocoa, many other crops that used to be plantation-type production systems, when workers got civil rights, they left and farmed on their own. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that farming is a household enterprise for most field crops all around the world, even today, 90%+ of farmers in the United States, in Japan, in Australia, in South Korea, in Africa, in South Asia, are family operations. That means that they're facing both input suppliers and product marketers that have huge scale economies in production, distribution of the inputs, in aggregation and assembly and transportation processing. So those scale economies before and after the farm create this common double-sided monopolies and monopsonies that we see in the complicated value chains that Amelia described. And of course, households, consumers are individuals as well. So the farm sizes are evolving based on what a family farm can afford to operate. Mm-hmm. And one of the great stylized facts or tragic stylized facts about agriculture is that the returns on land can essentially never pay for the borrowing costs of buying it. So, and there's a number of structural reasons for that, but essentially all farmers in the world have inherited some of the land that they farm and have, in some cases, acquired land, but only by bringing in very large amounts of capital that are not going to earn a competitive rate of return. So people will buy retirement farms, hobby farms, enjoyment farms, but you will not be able to repay out of the earnings from that the cost of borrowing. So what you have is a situation in which, as you said, large agribusinesses dominate the off-farm aspects of this food system, but households dominate production everywhere in the world, and even to an increasing degree over time.
One consequence of this unfortunate consequence is that the vast majority of these farms are either underinsured or uninsured. Is this something that you deal with in the book?
Yes, we do cover insurance and the lack of access to fairly priced insurance in the book. We cover it mainly in a chapter about poverty. So lack of insurance is really one of the poverty traps that you can think about for farmers that they face. And so we explore some of the uncertainty in farming and why there's so much uncertainty and risk in farming. This is a great example of an area of the food system that really needs just basic economics ideas to understand, such as asymmetric information, such as moral hazard, such as uncertainty itself, and missing markets as well. So we explore all those issues and how they jointly will make it challenging in some governance settings for insurance to be offered a price that people are willing to pay in a way that works for them in high-risk farming situations. And then in terms of the consequences of that, we explore that as well, including how it can keep smallholder farmers trapped in poverty, as well as some of the differential effects of this lack of insurance, lack of protection for poor farmers who are smallholder farmers in low and middle income countries versus farmers who are able to benefit from government protection and subsidized insurance in rich countries, and some of the political economy aspects that go into that disparity as well.
The development process, it does create a structural transformation out of agriculture. That's one of the big macro facts that we learn, but it is a very macro topic compared to the things we've been discussing so far. What consequences of that can you cover in your book?
Yeah, this is one of the oldest observations about economic life. And it comes from one of the stylized facts about food that's really not appreciated and understood, which is just how metronomic, how constant and limited food demand is. So one of the very astute observations among many in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations is that as people get richer, they don't increase the quantity of food consumed very much. That was written at a time when people couldn't actually measure quantity of food very well, but he observed it. We now know that the quantity in the sense of calories per day is roughly constant for a person over time. It's fixed by your height, your weight, your physical activity. Physical activity doesn't vary very much. So as people get taller or bigger, total energy consumed and intake does rise with their height and weight. And then, of course, kitchen and plate waste rises with income as people can afford to buy and discard food. And often discarding food is free. There's no charge to discard it. And so landfills are an important source of methane emissions from that. So total consumption does rise with income, but only because kitchen and plate waste is growing. And the increased expenditure on value-added services around food is not enough to make food spending shares grow with total income. And so this declining share of spending on food that comes from increased spending on the value-added services around food, not total quantity of calories, that is known as Engel's Law, one of the most famous early observations that richer people spend a smaller fraction of their income on food. And then similarly on the production side, nobody's making any new farmland. And so as people get more productive, acquire capital, education, infrastructure for other enterprises, successful farmers increase the yields of their land and increase value added from the land that they have, but they have to wait until their neighbors get non-farm jobs to rent in the land from their neighbors. And that's what happens as non-farm employment outstrips demographic population growth in more affluent countries around the world. So what you have is this transformation out of agriculture that you mentioned for the two reasons. On the demand side, Engel's Law, and on the supply side, the fact that prosperous farmers can't get any more land. And so they have to wait until their neighbors get other jobs to expand.
So one of the interesting things I noticed about the book is you're not just covering food production here, but also consumption, what we eat, how we eat. Do you also cover malnutrition as just having an unbalanced diet, the wrong kind of food?
Yes, we do. So the term for this in nutrition and in public health is the double burden of malnutrition. And sometimes it's called the triple burden or multiple burdens of malnutrition, depending on how you're kind of defining it. But what that entails is either individuals or households or communities that face both undernourishment, which in children is manifested as stunting and wasting and vitamin and mineral deficiencies, and then what's sometimes called overnutrition or overconsumption, which results in obesity and goes along with an increased risk of various non-communicable diseases, especially diabetes, but also heart disease and other non-communicable diseases as well, like cancer. So we cover behavioral food choices in the book. And for example, one topic that really matters for this is present bias. And this is a phenomenon that all of us face in our daily lives, where we think perhaps that our future selves are going to be much more patient and much more able to say, okay, I'm going to exercise today and I'm going to eat my vegetables and I'm going to not eat as much ice cream as I did the day before. But that present bias does compound over time. And this is definitely a physiological phenomenon and not just an economic phenomenon, but the present bias that we all face definitely results in some of those effects that we see on body sizes. So we also cover this in describing how the food system has changed and kind of the food environments that people face, where it's not just that people have more opportunity to eat more, but the environment that they're buying foods in is really conducive for overconsumption.
And specifically in development settings, are there things that we can learn about how the food system works with regard to overconsumption, with regard to poor behavioral choices?
Yeah, the term overconsumption itself is very interesting. I think people are generally using it, Amelia just used it, to mean total calorie intake causing unwanted or undesired weight gain, where people, after some months, discover, oh my gosh, I've gained a bunch of weight. I didn't intend to. And of course, weight is extremely difficult to lose. We're not like bears that will cycle in weight. We do observe very, very low-income people experiencing seasonal hunger and gaining and losing tens of pounds over the course of a cycle. And that's an extremely physically painful experience. People are very averse to that, and they will struggle to avoid losing weight. So overconsumption in total is that ratcheting up of weight gain. We actually know very little about what causes it. We know it's not driven by income and prices. People don't overeat because food is cheap, and people don't overeat because they're richer. We know that because incomes have fluctuated, prices have fluctuated without that. And we know that that has occurred despite low prices and despite high prices and despite low incomes and despite high income. So clearly, something about food composition and the food environment. Something about marketing and aspirations, something about food taste and food attributes, and the basic problem being that the composition of food in its nutritional aspects is not something you can see, taste, or smell. It's not something you can know, and it's something that's unknown and often misleading about food. We think something is healthy because it's been marketed as such, or because people used to think that was true. And so you went to school at an era when a certain idea about nutrition that's now discredited was prevalent. Or you happen to have had experiences early in life, or your family believes that a certain thing is healthy, and that's what you're told. We have one of the most sophisticated, advanced systems of scientific consensus to tell us what the latest evidence is. That's embodied in dietary guidelines. So the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee in the United States is convened every roughly 5 years, and similar methods used in other countries to build scientific consensus. There's also global efforts across countries to do this. And those dietary guidelines tell us what a balanced diet is in terms of food groups. And what we notice is that there's displacement of a healthy dietary pattern, which would have some but limited quantities of animal source foods, not necessarily meat, but some of that pre-digested, if you will, dairy, eggs, fish. Even in low-income countries, though, people love meat, and they especially love fried meat. Even in low-income countries, large quantities of some of these foods will displace the overall healthy diet balance that you would need with larger quantities of fruits, vegetables, of pulses, nuts, and seeds. Those are the food groups that are left behind as economic development proceeds, and that we're trying to put back on the plate by improving the processing, increasing how they're prepared, and make people able to have a balanced diet despite these preferences and tastes, as well as the marketing efforts that lead us to unbalanced diets that triggers the weight gain that then is the observed overconsumption.
So this book has the rigor of an economics text, but as you've both pointed out, you've tried very hard not to sound like economists. Is one of the things you hope for this that the next generation of economists might be able to talk about these very important topics to a wider audience?
Yes, we think that economics really can be for everyone. One of the first assignments that I assign in my classes that are economics classes and that I know Will assigns in his economics classes are essays about how you think like an economist in your everyday life. Mm-hmm. And really, everyone does do this. And one of the most important insights of teaching economics in this way is that it doesn't have necessarily anything to do with money or cash, right? Because you can think about trade-offs in other ways besides thinking about them in cash terms and in financial terms. We like to get students thinking about trade-offs in a much broader and holistic way in their lives, such as thinking about time and how they trade off their time, thinking about how they trade off their mental energy. And we think that the discipline of economics and the toolkit that's available to economists is really conducive for really studying anything. And especially, like we've been saying, the food system, because mm-hmm. it has this feature that people face choices that relate to food multiple times per day. And like Will was saying, people have very personal connections to their own food choices, and they are developed over long periods of time with respect to what the news media is reporting on and what they've tried that works or doesn't work, or their own personal health needs. What we hope is that this way of teaching economics through a specific topic like food that everyone knows about in their own personal way will maybe help everyone learn economics and will maybe help other economists to communicate how they do their work, which is very important as well.
So when both of you are not writing textbooks, you are teaching, and your classes will be some of the next generation of policymakers. Do you think that we could do a better job of food and nutrition policy, especially for low middle-income countries?
Oh, we can do a better job of all kinds of policy. You know, for humanity to keep addressing all of the many challenges we face, we need to bring science into the hands of decision makers. And absolutely, in this food and nutrition world, that science is often out of sight in specialized institutions, not brought to the attention, not brought to understanding. And so I absolutely hope that this textbook can be used primarily in African, Asian, Latin American universities to teach people in policy schools, as well as departments of economics, where future policymakers are being trained. Of course, some of this also matters in US, European, East Asian universities, in, you know, more affluent settings where people do influence policy in low and middle income countries, but are not themselves the citizens, not themselves the decision makers. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted it to be open access in large part so that it could be seamlessly integrated into courses in settings where people might have difficulty buying the physical book, but especially just low transaction cost. It's just really quick to adopt. Policymakers themselves can pick up and read this book, and I hope that some do, to see how they can use these stylized facts about the food system to their advantage. So in particular, there are many optical illusions in the food system that people see and believe are general truths that simply aren't. Mm-hmm. So for example, in a low-income setting, the bigger farmers with lots of land are more affluent. They appear to be more productive, but they're not. And finding a way to reach the mass of smallholders with the new technologies they need to increase productivity on family farms, that's where the real money is in terms of economic development in production. Similarly, on the nutrition side, packaged processed foods have a high level of food safety, low degree of contamination, but they might have these terrible nutritional attributes that cause diabetes, hypertension, and so forth. Trying to get this unseen attributes of the food system that are hidden in plain sight because they're distributed and inside of food and not something that you can see, taste, or smell, bringing that, what I describe as statistical reality, mm-hmm. reality that exists in the data that we can see through the textbook, bringing that to people's attention, I think is a high priority for me personally. You can just pick up this book, start to teach with it, learn things yourself. It will have slides for courses. We'll have example exercises and exam questions up on the website for the course. So just Googling food economics should give you what it takes to teach a class. And I hope for many policymakers, decision makers, and even private sector, civil society advocacy groups and people in food business will find a lot to learn. They know a lot about one particular thing, but seeing how all the dots fit together is a huge challenge. And I hope this book helps us to see food in a more joined up manner.
Will and Amelia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you very much, Tim.
So a reminder, the book is called Food Economics, Agriculture, Nutrition and Health. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. The authors, of course, Will Masters and Amelia Finere. It is available open access, and that's through the Agriculture, Nutrition and Health Academy. You can find that at anh-academy.org, or as Will suggests, just Google it. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as ever, at voxdev.org. And tell your friends about us.